I'm Leah, I'm an addict. I'm also a recovered addict, and I'm really pleased to be able to say that today. And the first time that I ever said that was when I came to a CA meeting, and I've never been on a podium before, and Glenn, you mentioned the microphone, it is really weird actually. And what really stood out for me already today was the preamble when Craig was reading that out. You know, it said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using cocaine and all other mind-altering substances. And I can honestly tell you that I did not come here with an honest desire to do that. I came to the rooms in 2016 because I was terrified. I was terrified of what was going on, of what was happening. I'd lost the control that I so cherished, and I had no idea where to go or what to do. And off the back of my last debauch, I looked up a meeting, and my motorcycle wouldn't start to get me to Narcotics Anonymous on a Friday, and so into Saturday Hackbridge I came. And I remember turning up to that first meeting, and I got a bus because I assumed that if I took my motorcycle, everybody would know me and know where I was going. I was too frightened to give my name. I was too frightened to look anybody in the eye. And I got off the bus, and I remember just this crowd of people standing outside, and some of them were in suits and ties, and everybody looked quite clean. I wasn't really sure about it. I wasn't really sure whether this was for me. And they said, are you looking for a CA meeting? And I couldn't even speak. I just nodded, you know, and they brought me in. And they sent me off to make a cup of tea, and everybody was so welcoming. Everybody was sort of saying hello and asking how I was, and it was all incredibly overwhelming because I felt useless inside, and I felt like I didn't deserve to be in a room full of people, like I didn't deserve to have a name, you know? And I went and sat down. I took a seat as far back in the room as I could get. And a lady who will be speaking tomorrow came and sat next to me, and she introduced herself, and she sat next to me on the outside. And I'm never sure whether that was out of kindness or whether to block my exit. but either way, you know what, it was one of the first things that kept me in the room was that someone came and sat next to me. And as they went around the room, they said, you know, you can introduce yourself as an addict, you know, if you want to. And I thought, well, if it makes her feel more comfortable, I'll go ahead and do that. So as it came round to me, I said, hello, I'm Leah, I'm an addict. And all of a sudden, this breath went out of me, and it was a breath that I remember, like we talk about that sense of ease and comfort. All at once, I felt I was at home, and like I could metaphorically just remove my shoes. I was in my own front room suddenly. You know, everywhere else, I've been feeling so unwelcome and like an alien. You know, I remember when I was younger, I was really, really into Harriet the Spy when that came out, if anybody remembers that film. And I remember sort of like sitting up in a tree with my notebook, you know, spying on people. But the reality of it was I was watching other people for how to behave. You know, I would make notes about how people act and write down how I should act because I felt alien in my own skin. If that makes any sense, or if anybody can identify with that. I wanted to watch how other people behaved, observe and note, so I knew what I was doing, or at least I could look like I knew what I was doing. You know, and that's generally the way I've kind of got through most of everything. I watch everybody else, watch what they're doing. I'm like, right, okay, I've got a general idea of how to do it, because deep down, somehow, I know whatever I'm gonna do isn't right. Whatever I'm gonna do, it's not the right thing. You know, I've got this absolute deep-seated fear in me that whatever I do, it's not good enough. I'm not good enough, you know. I remember going to a holiday camp with my dad, you know, those fantastic £10 sun holidays that you get dragged on, you know, and we're on the dance floor and there's some sort of disco going on, some shapes are being thrown in many directions, and my dad beckons to me, come to the dance floor, you know, come and have a good time, and I am absolutely rigid at the side and I cannot step one foot on there, and I can't believe he's embarrassing me this way. But on top of that, you know, inside, I'm 8 years old, and I am so frightened of what everybody else is going to think of me. I'm so terrified of how everybody else will judge me that I can't step one foot onto that dance floor. You know, and that same fear is with me again as I come into this meeting and I sit down. And the meeting begins and I'm stuck in my own self-pity. The meeting begins and I'm thinking about myself and, oh, how did it end like this? How have I become this? You know, because an addict is not a girl in her mid-20s. I'm sorry, but it's not, if you weren't aware. You know, by my standards, as I came in with, an addict is a man in his overcoat on a bench, roughly in his mid to late 40s, nursing a can of Super Tenants. You know, that was a very clear picture in my mind. And I was talking with someone before the meeting, and I was saying, you know, when I got in, and there were these women sat there, actual women that looked like women, clean, presentable, you know, I thought, well, they obviously have not come from where I've come from. they have obviously not done the things that I've done. And instantly, this deep-seated self-thinking is on me again. You know, this fear is in me again. And I'm sort of, you know, I've got to get out. But this fucking woman is sat next to me blocking my fucking exit. So I'm trying to remain. And the meeting begins and some things are being said and I just really can't take it in through all the thoughts that are racing in my mind, through all the beating up of myself that I'm doing again, you know. And then something stands out to me and somebody over on the left says, you know, they've invited a girl back to their house, you know, fantastic, and they've got in. I thought, yeah, I'm with you there. And then he said, and then, you know, she puts the music on and I think, you know, what the hell do you think you're doing? And I'm underneath the table. I'm like, yeah, actually. And then someone else pipes up and he says, you know, when it ends up, you know, by yourself in a box room. And I was like, actually, yeah, I do know about that. And then someone else used the word, you know, when you just go to oblivion. And it was like nails in my coffin. People didn't talk about this kind of using. You know, this is the kind of using that I had been doing, but, you know, no one knew. Everybody knew. No one knew. And you had me. You had me. You know? And they got to the end of the meeting and some more things were said and they started handing out these key rings and the woman next to me, you know, gestured me to go up and get one and people were clapping. That was very nice. And I came and sat back down. And then we all got up at the end of the meeting and everybody started holding hands. I thought, fuck, they're going to start singing Kumbaya. You know, and all of a sudden, everything that I'd got was completely deflated because you started talking about God. Had to be, didn't it? Absolutely had to be. I was outright offended that you would even offer me that as a solution. How dare you, when I have dragged myself here on the bus, how dare you then tell me it cannot be this? You know, I thought I had something there, and then you come out with the sandals and the tambourines. It's not for me. It's not for me, you know. And people kept talking to me after the meeting. I was trying to get back. I was trying to leave. And people kept getting me into conversations. And they said, you know, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's written on the wall. Of course, I'm going to worry about it. I can see it right there. You know, that's my number one offender. I'm not doing this. You know, and then they told me that I couldn't drink on top of everything. I'm a cokehead, so I don't have a drink problem. Thank you very much. You know, I was quite clear on that. And to be fair, I didn't really have a problem. I just wanted to use a little better, you know, as it had been before. Things had just got a little bit out of control. You know, I was scared. It's okay now. It's not so bad. It's all right. And I said, you know, I've got this trip with work. I couldn't possibly start this now. You know, it's just really not a good time for me. And I walked back out and I told them, of course, that I would be back because, you know, worried about their feelings. And something happened. You know, we were due to go on this all-expenses-paid trip to Thailand that I'd won with work. Fantastic, lovely thing to do. Except my using had now got to a point where I knew that I couldn't control it. You know, once I started, there was absolutely no stopping, and I could no longer control where I ended up. You know, the guise of control that I had in the first place were now beyond that. And I knew that there was nothing that I could do to hide it. I was on course, and it was pulling me forward, and there wasn't a single thing that I could do about it. I was terrified, you know, so I had to go on this trip. And they talk about higher power moments in this program, you know, and I've made it very clear how I came to these rooms and how I felt about that word and how, you know, I was pretty much terrified by the whole idea of it and very, very much against it. You know, I didn't want to be part of you, same way I didn't want to be part of life or part of the team or part of anything else. Just leave me alone with my cocaine in my room and I'm absolutely fine. You know, shutting myself off from everything and everybody. That was where I liked to be. And 15 minutes before we were due to go to the airport, I had a phone call, and the King of Thailand had died, and our plane was going to be diverted to Dubai. And I'm not insinuating that my higher power killed the King of Thailand, but this is just my story. And we ended up in Dubai, and, you know, I'm not getting anything from anybody on a camel. I'm stuck on a 5-star resort in the middle of nowhere. And I picked up a drink, and I put a drink down 5 days later. And 5 days later, I knew that you were exactly fucking right. You know, I knew that the solution was back in that meeting. And my first sober day was my last day in that country, and that was the 17th of October 2016. And I came back, and I listened, and I sat down, and I did what you told me, because I believed from that moment exactly that you knew what you were talking about. And it was never... You were always right, and it wasn't always a case that I was wrong, but sometimes I just didn't have the capacity to understand, but you loved me until I did. You know, and this fellowship has wrapped itself around me. Even when I've been holding you out at arm's length, you still continue to wrap yourself around me, you know. And so I came back and I sat in the meeting and I heard a woman speak and I identified with what she said. Although her story was very different to mine, I was told to listen to the similarities and I still try and do that today. You know, my story doesn't include prison, my story doesn't include rehab, my story doesn't include relapse, but that doesn't mean that I don't identify with each and every single addict. And I saw a woman that there was no way I was going to mess with, and I was serious about this. I picked the most terrifying person that I could find. You know, I am a master manipulator, I am a drug user, I am a drug addict, I am a liar, I'm a cheat, I'm a deceiver. Yeah, and if I think I can get one over on you, I'm going to. But this time I was going about my business. This time I meant business. I'd meant business a fair few times before. You know, coming into CA, I was coming off the back of a relapse on the LEA program, which hadn't been working too well, to be fair. You know, I'd been using, since I was maybe 12 or 13, various different substances over the course of my using. You know, starting off with alcohol and weed, as most of us do, it's the most accessible thing. And very quickly, I found the love of my life, cocaine. You know, and when that wrapped itself around me, I promised I would never let it go and that I would never run out of it. And I didn't. You know? And as time went on, I had some great times. You know, I had some fantastic 5 o'clock in the morning, sort the world out in the kitchen times, but unfortunately, once those people went home after their half a gram, which was just complete nonsense to me, I was still sat there 24 hours later and I didn't know why. You know, in my best thinking, I am just a much better partier than all of you and I will show you how it's done. In the worst of my thinking, I suspected that I might have a problem, but that was very quickly put away with more drugs, you know. And the LEA program consisted of changing people. Mainly other people are the problem on the LEA program, so it's best to avoid them where you can. Try and find people that are worse than you. That generally makes you feel better. Trying to keep your using quiet and in isolation. You know, don't let people know how much you're using and when. And, you know, try and substitute where possible. And on the last 7 months of the LEA program, I managed not to use cocaine for 7 months, which was the longest time I'd managed in about 13 years. And I was very pleased with myself. However, I was very aware that I was not using. Friday nights spent with fingernails in the sofa, you know, a miserable, miserable little thing. You know, the problem for me is when I stop using drugs, I expect things to get better and they just don't. You know, so I grab eBay and I grab men and I grab whatever else is available to try and make these things better because I've put the drugs down, so these are the things now that we're focusing on. You know, the insanity of my behavior takes me to attempt bungee jumps in order to try and change the way that I feel It incites me to completely change up my friends group and completely block people out of my life to change the way that I feel, because again, if you refer to step one of the LEAR program, it's other people that are the problem. And you know, continue to drink as much as possible, because while you're doing that, at least you're not thinking about drugs. You know, and at the end of the 7 months, I was a miserable, hateful, frustrated little being. You know, I still didn't want to be any part of life, and it was inevitable that I was going to use again, because that's what happens to me. You know, I can stop for a little while. I can stop for a little bit. I can get the 30 days. I can get the week. I can't stay stopped. I'm not happy staying stopped. You know, I need this. I need this is what I kept telling myself. You know, I deserve this. I've earned this. Until that then becomes not a choice any longer, and I have to have, and you need to get out of my way, and I don't need you, and I don't need this, I just need this. And all of a sudden, my entire life is being revolved around, moving everything around to bring my drug closer to me and everything else further away from me. You know, and this, when this woman spoke, she spoke of exactly the places that I'd been, and she spoke exactly of the way that I felt. You know, and instantly I knew that I wasn't going to mess around with her, you know. And so terrified after the meeting, I walked up to her and I said, how do I ask you to sponsor me? And she said, well, you just ask me. Even that was difficult. You know, the way that my mind works, it complicates the most simple of tasks. You know, A to B suddenly becomes via J in France. You know, it makes things complicated. Thank God for a simple program. Thank God for a simple program for my complicated mind, because I absolutely know I could not do this any other way, you know. And she gave me this little big book, and in the back of it, I duly wrote down her phone number, and it says, call at 8:30 a.m. I used to start work at 9 and get out of bed at about 8:40, so that was my first challenge. And I said, you know, are you quite sure? Could you not manage a little bit later if I get up at 8:30? And she said to me, when you start using, do you have any control over how much you're going to take or when you're going to stop? I said, none at all. And she then asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths to stay clean and sober. And I'll echo my sponsor here, and I said that I said yes, even though I didn't really know what it meant at the time. You know, and she told me to pray, which I duly ignored. She then told me to meditate. She told me to write a gratitude list. I didn't know what that was. I asked a lot of questions. She said to call her at 8:30. And she said to read 2 pages of my big book and read it 3 times. She said, told me to get to meetings. She told me to get numbers of women, and then she told me to call them. To get service, to get home group, and to end of every evening pray. Now I'll come back to God here, because it was a problem for me in the beginning. It's not a problem for me today. You know, I have a God in my life today. And that doesn't mean that I've become an evangelist. It means that I accepted a higher power of my own understanding into my life. And when I couldn't comprehend what that was, and I still don't really comprehend what that was, I saw miracles in the rooms of CA, and I saw some amazing things happening here. There are some amazing people in this fellowship. There really, really are. And, you know, the more meetings that I got to, the more miracles I found. So I praise to CA and the rooms of CA and to what happened in here, because that was so much bigger than me. It was so much more than I could ever achieve. And a few days went together, and she told me to look for signs of this higher power. I was like, okay. But I did what she told me, because I was so desperate. I was so desperate. You know, she told me to not forget my last use. And I remember, you know, having gone off the back of this 7 months of not using, how cocky I felt, and it talks about in Bill's story, I could laugh at the gym mills. And I did, you know, my cocksuredness. And, you know, just like Bill's story, again and again, you know, where was my high resolve? Every time I tried, I failed. You know, everything that I had tried didn't work. I had changed all of the people now. I had gone to every different pub. I had tried using in different places, and nothing was working. And I was at the end. I was at the end. You know, I remember the last weekend, you know, I'd gone out, I'd invited about 5 to 7 strangers back to my home. one of who had run out in terror at the state of me the next morning at 10 o'clock in the morning when I was calling it on again, because that's what surrounds me. My using is not in a cocktail bar surrounded by nice looking men. It's not, despite what my mind will play me as this Spielberg-esque, sort of drama in which I, am throwing my head back in laughter or wearing a lovely dress. It's not. It's me sweating my nuts off in a fucking front room over the same table for 3 days while everybody else looks at me and tiptoes around me in a disgusted form. That's what my using looks like. That's where I live. And on that last use, I'd been up another 24 hours after that last person had fled, and my partner at the time came home, and he said, "Are you coming to bed?" I said, "Does it look like I'm coming to bed?" For the 100th time. And as that door closed, something changed. It suddenly mattered. And it didn't matter how many wraps had gone before and how many I had on the table and how many were in my pocket or how many I was inevitably going to call on. It wasn't enough anymore. It wasn't going to change it. It wasn't going to make me feel better. It wasn't going to change the way I felt, the way I needed it to. As long as I can remember, all I've ever wanted is just to be out of my head, out of my mind. And when I came to these rooms, people used the same phrases as me, and it terrified me, but it intrigued me. And it kept me here, and it kept me listening, because I identified with that painful place. By the end, my using had become calling it on and being unable to speak until it arrived. My life was on a pause until it was in my hands, and the minute that it was in my hands and he went away again, I was already panicking of where the next one was going to come from. And that was a constant cycle. What is that? And then I carried on following these suggestions, and I never had another day like that. The obsession to use left me quickly and never returned for me, as were it was in the promises. And I started to work through the steps. And step one was really apparent to me. I'd come to believe that I was unmanageable. I'd come to believe that I was powerless. And then step two came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I wasn't sure about being restored to sanity. I felt far past it when I got here. It talks about in Bill's story, not being, people were worried for his sanity and so was he. And I very much identify with that as well, And coming to believe, I came to believe that after what I saw in these rooms, it could happen for me as well, because it was happening to women around me. It was happening to women like me. It was happening to my brothers ahead of me. It was happening to people behind me. I could see it everywhere. I could feel it everywhere. And I could feel that change coming upon me. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. I don't know if I meant every word that I said when I did this step, but it carried me through. 4, my house got really clean on step 4 because I really loved to procrastinate on this one. Write a little bit down, get up, maybe clean a little bit so I don't have to do any more. But after a thorough mental and physical house cleaning, I had a brand new sparkly house. And I was on my way to a brand new sparkly life as well. 5, I admitted to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. Let me make it very clear before I came to CA, I was not wrong. the Leah program was working just fine. I had an absolute stubbornness for anything that anybody told me. You couldn't tell me anything. And finally, coming here, I'm so pleased about it that I was beaten into a complete and utter pulp of submission, and I was quite happy to do any of these suggestions as long as I didn't have to use again. And you kept telling me if I did this stuff, I didn't have to use again, so I'm just going to keep doing the stuff, and I'm not going to use, and that's going to be okay, because you told me that it would be, and I believed you. And then on to 6, ready to have God remove all my defects of character. Those came up in my 4 and 5. I wasn't aware that I had any defects before I came here. I thought I was doing pretty well for myself. I thought I was a very nice person, doing a lot of things for other people. My step 4 and 5 showed me otherwise. You know, I'd been living a really selfish life. I'd been living a life that was really just for myself. I'd been harming a lot of people. You know, I'd been harming myself an awful lot. And, you know, I'd been harming myself spiritually as well, you know. And by the time that this came around, you know, God was ever present in my life. And when I look back through my using and when I look back through my life, I can see that God was present in various different places. You know, my sponsor asked me, you know, when I got on my knees and asked for help, who was I even asking? I didn't have an answer for that. I remember bargaining with God an awful lot. If you'll let me have, if I can. You know, I remember on one particular occasion, my ex-partner, who was also one of us, made a particularly devastating suicide attempt and was left on life support for many months. You know, and I promised God that if he let him live, then, you know, I would dedicate my life to him. You know, I would stop using and I would live a better life. You know, and I held it together until he made that turnaround after being given 10% chance to live. That man pulled through and went on to walk again after complete organ failure. It was a miracle, you know, and I went about my using as hard as I ever had after that. I'll bargain with God all the time, but this time I needed his help and I was willing to accept it, and this time I wasn't bargaining. Humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings and then made a list of the people I'd harmed. I made direct amends to them. I said that I was sorry, I asked for forgiveness, and I asked if there was anything that I could do to make it better. Because, absolutely, sometimes it was just a case of staying away from them. You know, that was how I could make their life better. On other occasions, I was pleasantly surprised. And on 9, made direct amends and continued to take personal inventory. Inventory is a massive part of what I do today. You know, inventory is where I sit down for myself every evening and I look at my day. Never did that during my using. You know, my life before I came to CA was about living the day for myself, trying to get through without using. And if I didn't get through without using, pretend that I'm going to not use again tomorrow. You know, that was the best that I could do. I didn't look at my selfishness because I didn't see any selfishness. I saw that other people were trying to get in the way of my good time. I saw people that were trying to get in the way of my life and trying to exert themselves onto me. When in fact, the little tornado that I was creating in my own home was awful, you know? And I never thought that I could forgive myself. But thanks to working these steps, you know, I can understand that I've got a disease. I mean, going through the doctor's opinion was an absolute revelation to me. You know, I remember sitting down with my sponsor and opening this book and going through the doctor's opinion, and she said to me, you have an allergy. I thought, this poor woman's not well. She hasn't been listening. I've told her how I've been using. She clearly doesn't understand. You know, and she offered to get a dictionary. I humoured her, and off she went to go and get one, and she came back and we looked up the definition of an allergy. You know, and the drugs, as it turned out, were but a symptom, you know. And ultimately, the exact thing that I didn't want to be the problem, me, was me, after all. And the way that my illness presents itself is in the form of a malady. You know, that voice that told me when I was 8 years old, you can't get on that dance floor and enjoy yourself, you're not worth it. You know, the malady that tells me you're awful. The malady that tells me that I'm not good enough. And the malady that tells me that and leads me to, you know what's going to make this better, don't you? You know, a lie. Ultimately. You know, that every time I bought, every time, you know, I followed that white rabbit down that hole. You know, I was spiritually sick. And I didn't realize it. You know, I didn't realize that I needed to be connected. I didn't realize that I needed other people. You know, but going through this book and finding out that my allergy presents itself in a very different way. It's not rashes and all the other sort of usual symptoms that you'd associate with a physical allergy. Mine's invisible, but I know it's there. I know it's there. And I know that I can never safely drink or use again because of that. You know, and I accept it. I accept it, and you know what? Recovery has changed everything for me. Not only do I not drink and use every day, not only have I become present in the lives of others and my own life and present for work as well, it's changed the way that I felt, and I didn't really think that that was going to happen. You know, when I started looking at the steps, I was really adamant that I wasn't saying sorry when I skipped to number 8 down the list. I was adamant that I wasn't going to be choosing a God or accepting one into my life. You know, but today I can actually wake up and open the curtains. That never happened in my using. You know, I can open the curtains not only to the morning, but to my life every day, because I'm happy to be alive. I'm actually happy to be here. I actually want to be here. I want to be a part of life. You know, and it talks about how we go about this in Bill's story. And it says that my friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems, and it does. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things with the essential requirements. It tells me exactly there what I need to make a beginning. I really like that paragraph. You know, and it goes on to say that simple but not easy, a price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness, and I must turn in all things over to the Father of Light who presides over all. And so I try and live my life today in 10, 11, and 12. I take my inventory every day and look at where I can do better, because I can do better. You know, I seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him. And ultimately, I try and carry the message to someone else, because that's really where the magic in this program first appeared to me, is in these rooms, and by someone else carrying a message to me, because when I arrived to a meeting, the chairs were out, the literature was out, someone made me a cup of tea, people welcomed me and people came and sat next to me, and ultimately I stayed because you did those things. I sat in that meeting and I listened to what you had to say and I believed you, and you gave me hope when I didn't have a hope, when I didn't have anything else. You know, so why would I not continue to do this? You know, why would I not continue to do this when I can wake up with peace of mind, which I never had before? You know, CA hasn't given me a life I never had, it's given me one that I was never going to have. In charge of my own life, I don't know where I would be. You know, and I was very naive when I got here, and I heard people's stories of prison, and I heard people's stories of using harder drugs than I'd used, and I got very judgmental around that. You know, I realize now that most of those things that I hear are just yets for me. They're just places that I didn't have a chance to get to. But given the right set of circumstances, and if I choose to stop doing this program, if I choose to stop taking suggestions, and if I choose to stop doing what keeps me well, I'm under no illusion that that's what's waiting for me. Absolutely no illusion. I have to be connected to God. I have to be connected to my fellowship. I have to be in service. I have to have a home group. I have to have all of these things. I cannot choose one bit and the other bit. I cannot fill my tank up with a little bit of recovery and drive on that for 10 miles. It's not going to work. I have to do this stuff every day. If I don't do this stuff every day, I will feel it. I will feel it in the way of that malady returning, and eventually I will drink again, or I will use again. So I do this stuff because I want to, but because my life depends on it as well. And I would suggest that you do the same. If you have come here and this is your first time here, you are very much welcome. And I'd just like to end on the last bit of Bill's story. And that is that there is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath there is a deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. Thank you.